This is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Lehman, Jay, and Mark. And today we will be furthering, we're getting into the setting slash purpose of the game. So in Torg Eternity, with the different realities, it's almost as if each one is its own game in itself, its own setting, its own purpose. So we will be jumping back into that. But before that, we do have a couple of emails. But even before the emails, I was going to say we might, I know we missed a couple weeks, but we'll probably miss a few more weeks, both because if you're listening to this in a couple of days, I will be at Gen Con, so you might be able to catch me there. After that, I am finishing up some training at my day job as a forensic scientist, so that is keeping me busy a lot of August while I wrap up that training, so scheduling is a little off. It doesn't mean that we're not doing these anymore, it's just that I am not going to be in town for a lot of August. So having said that, let's go ahead and get to the emails. So the first email is from Oliver. It says, "Hi again. This week's questions are mostly related to interpretation of rules, language, and possible extension of the effects. So there's five questions. Two of them are kind of related to each other. We'll just go one at a time. So the first one is regarding the Ingenious perk. The perk says, on a success, she may immediately draw another Destiny card and put it into any player's hand. Is that any player's hand, including yourself, or any other player's hand, excluding yourself? So in effect, does this allow you to draw two cards or only one and give one to another player? Intent for 1+1 is mostly clear, but the wording, in my opinion, is not, or one and one. So yeah, if we go to Ingenious, it does say just once per scene is a simple action. The character, you need to spend a possibility, you draw a Destiny card and make a mind test. On a success, you immediately draw another Destiny card, put it into any player's hand. Good, you draw two, select one, put it into any other player's hand. And outstanding, you draw three and select one. So depending, you're only going to ever get two cards no matter what you select, but you're spending a possibility. And it does say any player. Personally, I would just take that as any player. I know intent sometimes doesn't always get brought across, but I don't know who came up with this perk. So I would say any player. You're only going to be able to do it once per scene, and you're going to need to spend a possibility to even do it, and you're going to need to make a mind test, which, depending on how good or bad you roll, might require another possibility. So it's not like it's just something that you're doing all of the time. So that would be how I view it. Any player's hand is any player's hand. Listening to or knowing past things where certain spells have said like characters, but the language says like your opponents, and it not counting against your friends, certain things like that. So since it costs a possibility, possibly more, that's how I would rule it. So Jay, what would your thoughts be on this one?
Yeah, to me it seems pretty simple because it says put it into any player's hand. So that's any player. So you get one, and then you get a second one that you can do whatever you want with. Mm-hmm. And to me, they had their chance to change it because this was reprinted in the Pan Pacifica source book.
Right.
So I could probably assume Deanna was, because it's from the Nile Empire source book originally, and then it was reprinted in the Pan Pacifica source book. So it's got, they had the chance to update it, and they didn't. They left it like that, so that seems like rules as intended to me.
And there was a big enough gap between those two that it was.
Yeah.
So, Mark, did you have a different opinion, or what would your opinion be on this?
No, I'm right with you. I think the first, so you got two cards. Let's just assume a success. You got two cards. The first one is going to go into your hand. Mm-hmm. And that's the only place that one can go. I think the intent then on a success gives you the ability to get a second card that you can do whatever, like Jay said, whatever you want with it. I think the key to this, the where this rules is written, whatever is important, is if you did this in combat, it's number mm-hmm. one, it's going into hands. Mm-hmm. There is not a pool here. And so if you've got somebody that you need to get a card into somebody because they don't have cards, I mean, it's not as cool as putting it direct, like leadership. I can put cards into your pool with leadership, right? This is going into, but you can give it to someone else. And if for some reason you decide you need to put a card in someone else's hand, just a card, or you can with this, right? But you don't control what the card is because the first one goes to you and the second one is the one you can do what you want with. You can't, I was paying attention but not listening, if that makes sense, when you were reading it off. Unlike an outstanding success, you get to draw three. Maybe there's some flexibility in there, which one you keep and which one you give away at a higher level of success. And that makes it cooler, I guess. It seems fairly straightforward to me the way it's written, because it says any. So if you want to keep it as the you spent a possibility to get a couple cards, which is, I mean, to me, that seems kind of a steep price unless you're fishing for a specific card, which is fine too. Mm-hmm. Seen that happen quite a bit. And sometimes when you got to have that one card, you just got to have that one card. And so, okay, here we go. We're off looking for it. But the first one is yours and the second one is the one you can do whatever you want with it. You can keep it or you can give it to somebody else.
Right.
But it matters. Order of operations there matters.
And that's where I would point out that it says you spend a possibility to draw a destiny card. Boom. That's your card. And then you take a mind test. So you draw the card first, that's your card. And then on that mind test, then you could get up to three cards. You choose one of those, and that's the one that you give to whoever. So that first card is not part of that three cards to figure out which one you get. So it's not like you get three cards and choose two cards. So the
and
first
presumably one is, the other two cards are discarded?
Yes.
That would be my presumption.
Yeah.
Yep.
Said that Ingenious out on outstanding is where you get the three.
Yes. Yep. On a good success, she may draw two cards and select one to put into any player's hand. On an outstanding success, she may draw three cards.
Yep.
So
So there's four on outstanding. There's four cards involved there.
Right.
And I'm with you on that. That first one is, in every case, that first one goes to you.
Right.
You have turned a possibility into a card,
mm-hmm.
which normally I would say is not a good deal.
Yeah, for a random.
So, well, it's the outstanding
unless you've peeked at it somehow.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be those small little cases that it might be, but for the most part, no. But hey, if somebody wants to do it, like you said, sometimes trying to fish and get what you need is important. So
yep.
But we'll go ahead. I think we answered that one. So now we're going to move to Telekinetic Strike, which I'm going to give an answer that probably is not going to be welcome. But right. Telekinetic Strike, which is on Pan Pacifica, page 54, 55, says increase all damage from unarmed combat. Is that eligible for all attacks that roll unarmed as a skill or only true unarmed attacks made by the character? Example, using telekinesis mage hand to attack unarmed at range. So I will make the statement that I gave before, which is anytime you see unarmed combat stacking, that is absolutely a game master call, because there are clear examples where authors have forgotten that there are like brass knuckles and other things that add to unarmed attack. And there's like one of them, I don't remember which one it is, that came out specifically said something like one paragraph it says it applies to all unarmed combat attacks, and the next one it was talking about natural weapons only. So you have a two different rules interpretation. So with all of the stacking and stuff, that is something that we have fixed for the Tor Gear 2 rule set coming out. But for stuff going on now, I will just say this is absolutely Game Master's call, because I don't want to get into something that is already fixed in the background. So, Jay, how would you run Telekinetic Strike?
I would say that it only affects true unarmed attacks that you're doing on your person and would not apply to any mage hand or anything like that, specifically because it has a range of self. Mm-hmm. So it does not take any effect away from you, if that makes sense. Like, you have a range on your mage hand, you don't have range on the Telekinetic Strike. Mm-hmm. You're not casting Telekinetic Strike on the mage hand. You're casting it on yourself. Well, you're manifesting it on yourself.
Right.
So, yeah, I would definitely leave it for just personal hand-to-hand combat. Whether it goes on stacking, like, brass knuckles and things, that's the GM call part.
Right. Okay. So, Mark, your thoughts on Telekinetic Strike.
So, I'm looking at Mage Hand. I haven't made up my mind, but I'm gonna take the devil's advocate on Jay's position, and I'm willing to go back and forth because I'm not sure, and I want to play it, game it out, have the discussion to come to a decision. Because it says the wizard can manipulate items as if she had a pair of invisible hands that can reach up to 25 meters of distance. The hands are extensions of her own. Her real hands must be free, and she makes appropriate hand motions, and she can lift herself any more easily than she could with her own hands. The hand's strength is equal to her spirit, but they use her skills. My knee-jerk reaction when I read this and as we were going through it was, well, if you're using the unarmed combat skill, then yes. Well, in the mage hand is an extension of your hands, and it's using the unarmed combat skill. But Jay's ranged statement is fairly compelling. However, the verbiage of Mage Hand says it's an extension of my hands, as if I were like, you know, Stretch Armstrong, like reaching out there with hands really
Mr.
long.
Mr. Fantastic.
There we go. And so, but I can't see him because it's magic, right? And so if we have these magical Mr. Fantastic arms with hands on the end of them, why is that not acceptable to allow Telekinetic Strike to stack with my unarmed combat? Because I'm just doing it. I got really long arms now.
Yeah, so that's why I will keep my Game Master call. because, and this is something else. We get influenced by other games. So if you ever played, like, Dungeons & Dragons, you already have a mental thing of what Mage Hands in that game is. It's kind of a floating hand off there. Where in Torg Eternity, you could have it, like Mark said, where it's like psychic hands extending from your own that go around and do stuff. So that's just...
That's not a decision on my part. I'm waiting to hear Jay's rebuttal on that.
So, Jay!
I mean, I don't really have a specific rebuttal to it. You get old Mage Hands back here. Well, it also partially comes from the Telekinetic Strike too, where it's talking about,
yeah, that's where I'm going now,
your limbs are increasing the kinetic energy around them, and the Mage Hand isn't really a limb per se.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to go like super rules as written, then in theory sure, but then it also specifically says Telekinetic Strike doesn't work with weapons except natural weapons. So here we go back into this again.
It is magic.
Well, I mean,
hands,
we're
natural.
Doing, yeah, we're doing unarmed. I'm not saying it's a sword. I'm saying an unarmed strike. If you're using the unarmed combat skill.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about, let's say you've got 25 meter long arms, basically. So if you were some crazy Stallinger or something,
right,
with tentacles that could reach 25 meters, then casting it would work. So I think with Mage Hand, we're getting into a weird situation because it says as if you had a pair of invisible hands, not that you do have a pair of invisible hands, and it kind of seems like we're pick and choosing the fluff.
Right.
Because sometimes people are like, well, it just says this, but then the
fluff
means
it's completely. See, I disagree with the whole fluff idea. The words matter to me.
Okay.
Well, so, but let's take the words. It says telekinetic strike cannot be used to enhance weapons. And your point right there, we're talking about mage hands. We're not talking about your hands. So
I think it was that it's only for natural weapons. And if you have mage hands, that's a magical, not natural.
I'm willing to take that and run with it and say no.
So
yeah, I'm willing. That coupled with the range thing that Jay brought up, which I think is fairly compelling, the two of those together, like, no, we're not doing this with mage hand.
So
the question is, yeah, like, what is the subject, I guess?
Right. Is it about true?
I guess if
unarmed
it's you
attacks,
having 25 meter long arms, the self would still work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but these are extensions of her own.
Right. Now, I would say
they
it would,
aren't her own, they're extensions.
I would say it wouldn't
so,
work
there you
with
go.
Telekinesis.
I'm done.
That's one. So that one's a little easier because telekinesis isn't part of your body, so you wouldn't be casting it. And again, casting it on yourself, mage hand has that extension of yourself, telekinesis doesn't. So yeah, sometimes you do, you get into these little case where yes, no, yes, no, and like each thing kind of, do you need to put a check mark for each yes and no and count them all up at the end? Do you want to do that? Do you just want to go with what might be cool this time? Maybe you make a ruling at the table and then you go, but I'm going to think about that. You know, here's my ruling for now. Let me think about it when I have more time and I'll give you a more concrete ruling. But anything that deals with unarmed combat and stuff stacking, I just am not dealing with because it's,
yeah,
it
personally, like, that's part of why I said it too. Like, we could sit here and debate minutiae for a long time, but like, we get in that situation, there's an Ororsh ritual, I think, that lets you like cut your hands off.
Mm-hmm.
And they can run around and do stuff. So if you do telekinetic strike and then you send those hands off, can they, you know, can they karate chop people extremely well? So personally, it says self, I would limit it just to what you are doing personally.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this all comes back to what Lehman said, which is check with your GMs.
I'm
gonna be GM dependent.
I'm gonna end up with the no, you can't do it with mage hands. And I may have made a ruling to the other side of that coin, but I do recall saying, yeah, well, I'll think about it,
mm-hmm.
as you were talking about. So yeah, it's I've thought about it. No.
Okay.
That's not gonna be happy.
So let's move on to Springing Leap, which is a Tharkhold mutation. The character ignores 4 points of multi-targeting when doing melee or unarmed attacks. Does this apply for any attacks using melee unarmed as a skill, telekinesis, mage hand, and does it stack with the reduction from Whirlwind, as Whirlwind states to ignore the first 2 points when making melee / unarmed multi-targeting, while Springing Leap ignores any 4 points. So for the first question, I'll say listen to what we just talked about, and I'll give the same answer for that. It's just going to be a game master, although I would go more for I'm just going to say stacking with unarmed combat stuff, I'm just not going to deal with at this point in time. But for the Whirlwind, there are very specific ones. Whirlwind is the most readily available to mind, but there are other things that specifically say ignore the first 2 points or the first 4 points or the first 6 points. And then if those stack, if one is the first 2 points and the other is the first 4 points, you're only ignoring 4 points because they don't add together. Something like this, where it says for it just says the character ignores 4 points of penalties. It's a mutation. Every few mutations, you got to do the bad thing that can affect you. You have a penalty. So for this one, I would say you choose where those 4 points are. You would choose them back end, front end, after whatever points are being ignored. So that's how I would rule it, and I think that's how I've heard it being done in the past when things similar to this were brought up. But Jay, how would you handle this one?
That was going to be my big question, actually. This is actually a much bigger question than this specifically. It's more about how to stack.
Mm-hmm.
Not bonuses, but ignoring penalties, right? And I think the way you said it is good. If it specifically says the first two, those two wouldn't stack. But if it just says it ignores two, then they would stack. The only issue is I'm not really entirely sure that every writer has necessarily had that in mind when making this. So should Springing Attack have said ignores the first 4 points or just ignores 4 points? In my experience, the mutations are wildly varying in power, and they do have significant drawbacks. So I'm fine with keeping this as 4 and allowing it to stack, because otherwise it's that and mainly, I think, some path powers that let you get even better versions of Whirlwind. So it's good to have another way, because a lot of times path powers just seem like the best way to do everything.
Right.
So it's good to have other options. So yeah, I pretty much agree with what Demon said.
And Mark, what would your thoughts on the Springing Leap be?
So it's interesting that it comes up on the page that the stacking box is on as well. And I'm going to fall back on the default answer in that call out box. It says, unless otherwise stated, any increase or decrease is a bonus. The GM makes the final call, but when in doubt, it doesn't stack. And there are numerous occasions in the Torg Eternity rules where when the intent was that it stacked, it specifically says that it does, like Deathclaw. And Brawler, they say they stack with other things. So I'm going to default with the idea that it does not, that you've got Whirlwind ignores 2 points, and then you've got Springing Leap says ignores 4 points. I'm with Liam on the idea that this, they overlap, but you ignore 4 points. You're not ignoring 6. I mean, if you combine Whirlwind, you combine with the Springing Leap with a Whirlwind attack, are you going to ignore 6 points of damage? 6 points of damage, 6 points of penalties? I see how you could make the case to do that in the game, but this game system specifically says this game system is specifically anti-stacking in almost all cases. There are cases where it calls it out, and so I'm down with the idea of it, they don't stack.
Okay. So like Jay said, the thing that you as a game master are going to want to think about is, do you take that stacking rule that Mark discussed, and do you just apply that to bonuses and penalties, or do you apply them to ignoring of bonuses and penalties? It sounds like Jay and I are a little more lenient. Mark just takes it as which is fine, takes it as a just, unless it specifically says it does, it doesn't. Hopefully I can at some point start doing some teasing, but one of the things is we have made stacking stuff clear. So yeah. All of the questions, does it stack, doesn't stack, there's one nice rule that
is days are numbered.
Things will be very clear on when things stack and when they don't stack. So Yes, so let's move on to 4 and 5. So 4 and 5 are both about Bulletsmith gun modifications, or the gun customizations. I think the Customed Slayer's Gun is the name of the perk.
Yep.
Which is for Bulletsmith gun customization is the double barrel modification compatible with other modifications like pistol stock. Would this grant 2 reaction attacks if both pistols are wielded? And 5 is which gun modifications exclude others? Obviously pistols and long barrel, but can long barrel and reinforced chamber be taken together? Thanks again, Oliver. So, Oliver, thank you for the question. I think my answer is going to be very different from others, except for Game Masters, of course. If you see some of these things being completely incompatible, that's fine. What I'm looking at is there's a lot of perks, and it's going to take 96 XP to get all of these if you want to try to completely cheese everything and stick it all together. For the first question, which was, does this grant 2 reactions? No. The double barrel just says that you can get one free action that you... It says, when a foe moves into melee range, the slayer may fire this barrel and... whatever round is loaded into it at the attacker as a free action. So if somebody did double barrel and then did pistol stock, or did pistol stock, which is the slayer's gun is converted into 2 equal pistols. Each has its own cylinders. Both pistols count as the same weapon for trademark weapon and other abilities. That's where you got it. It counts as the same weapon. So this in theater, if you think of the movies or the TV show, this is the one that the guy has the 2 pistols, and maybe they are double barrels, or, you know, and the one barrel just has the extra. The guy steps into range and he shoots both of them off at the same time. It's not going to give you more than what that perk said. So the perk was you get one reaction that fires it. So with the pistols, it would be you have one reaction that fires both of them, but they only do the one job because the perk gives you one. The perk doesn't give you 2.
Which one were you reading?
The double barrel and the pistol stock combined.
Pistol stock. Okay.
So basically pistol stock is you have 2 pistols instead of one normal slayer gun. Double barrel adds an extra barrel that just keeps one. If somebody moves into range, then you can shoot that extra barrel. So I'm just saying you're shooting both of them, but it's only giving the one effect. Or, you know, if you want to have it, because if you want to describe it that they're shooting the one, they shoot the one, but you don't have another one for the next round until you spend the time to reload it or them. It's one of the things, and especially whenever... this is my opinion, when any game starts talking about firearms, there's lots of firearms experts, and there's lots of firearm experts that disagree, and there's lots of people who think they're firearm experts and will disagree. And trying to say what is real and what is not when you talk about movie logic or TV logic is not going to get you anywhere, because... Like, they talk about pistol stock, it converts it to 2 equal pistols, but they have cylinders, so therefore they're revolvers, and revolvers aren't pistols. Pistols and revolvers are both handguns. Explode, you know, and then they talk about bullets, but they're cartridges, you know, not actually the bullet. And, yeah, it will make your mind explode, figuratively. For the next one, which is the gun customization, this is something that I personally wouldn't have a problem if somebody had a Slayer's gun that had a bunch of little big barrels and all the types of weird stuff on it, and they spent all their XP, 96 points, to get every one of these. If they could come up with an explanation how they do it, they could do it. Because I'm just looking at, wow, they just spent a lot of XP. Now, some of these will either shorten or lengthen the range. So, and then you have to determine, okay, so if I get the pistol stock first and shorten my range, or if I get the reinforced chamber and shorten my range, and then I get long barrel to increase the range, is that going to be different than if I start off with long barrel that increases the range and then I move to pistols or reinforced chamber that shorten that long range? Do you wish to have the difference? I don't know. Every game master is going to have to come up with their own thing and be like, yes, they work. No, they don't. Honestly, my selection would be, if I, as a game master, thought that they were incompatible, I would either say, okay, you kind of have you have pistols, but you also wanted something with a long barrel. Okay, either A, you have the Joker's gun from the Tim Burton's Batman, where he pulls it out of the, you know, and you have this long barrel revolver going on, or two of them. Or you do something where you take an action and you switch out a barrel, or you switch out whatever the special thing is with whatever the other special thing is. You know, you affix your bayonet to it if you have blade, and then if you want to put the potion launcher on it, then you take, you know, off the blade and you put the potion launcher and you make it convertible, but you have another downside to it. So I know that was long and convoluted, but I would just be if I try to think of any of these logically, it's not going to be cinematic, and if I think of it cinematically, it's not going to be logical. So game masters, determine where your point in that logic to movies and TV logic are. What do you want to do, and do you just want to let anything and everything go, or if you combine things that are mutually exclusive, like reducing range and extending range, do you split it in the middle, or do you just say nope, can't do it? You make them, you do you allow them to buy Bulletsmith again, and now they have two Slayer guns that they can do their stuff? I don't know. I like them, but there is no guidelines, so you're going to have to make up your own guidelines. So after that long ramble, Jay, what are your thoughts?
So my opinion is basically the exact opposite. I had no problem with combining double barrel with pistol stock and giving them two under barrels. Like, I basically was looking at it as being a Lamat or something. So I guess if they used both at the same time, they might get like a +1 to hit on it or something. Otherwise, they could wait for two different times. I don't really see a huge issue with that, because the pistol option is kind of not that good anyway, you know? So, and then the other thing was, for the second half, my thought was, if you have to ask, it probably doesn't work. But then, as Lehman was talking about it, it was kind of like, yeah, it's true. It's a lot of XP. And these are occult guns. They're not normal guns. Like, so you could have it even be like, you say some secret word and green fire wreaths it and reconfigures the barrel or something like that. So you could probably explain it. Yeah, and trying to put real life gun knowledge into this, especially, but any RPG for the most part, mm-hmm. is usually a pain. I do like modifying their guns. I had modifications, some of these modifications, in an Infiniverse thing as well. So I'm definitely up for modding them. But yeah, so I guess over the course of Lehman's long discussion, I've mellowed on it and would probably allow you to just, you know, if some Nile Empire guy can have a ray gun that shoots out of his belt buckle, that freezes people, then why not?
Mark, what are your thoughts on all the Bulletsmith gun customization?
So I've kind of got two answers. I'm gonna put on the let's play, we're playing a home game kind of thing answer, but then I've got a organized play answer, which is a little different. I love the imagery that Jay throws out there with the occult energy reconfiguring your gun. I think that's a fabulous idea. I liked Liam's, you know, I've got this kit of accessories and I wanted to do this and I take this piece off and put this piece on, or, you know, it's a modular weapon system kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So the home game answer to, and I'm also in Jay's camp, and the home game answer to me, having a firearms background, I have seen a wide variety of custom gunsmithed firearms come through the shop. I've seen some built, I've built some. It's not unusual to see. I can see how all of these in a world where magic works. I can see how all of these things would work on a gun that you could put together where occult energy and magic and those things exist. And so it doesn't, you know, even some of these things that folks without gun knowledge look at and go, well, that's kind of counter. How do you do that? It makes sense to me. So I don't have a problem with you going out there and getting the long range thing and then shortening the range because you did, you know, you put the long barrel on, and then when you put this on there, you had to chop a little bit of it off, and it changes the aspect and the dynamics of what you're doing. Okay, fine. I mean, I've seen pistols that have an extremely long, you would think of them as Joker barrels, but they use them, you know, some folks like to do hunting at extreme ranges with handguns, and it can be done. So, you know, from a real world standpoint, which this is an RPG and we don't do that, these things are not that far away. You can do a bunch of this stuff. So I'm not offended by the idea that this mod cannot go with this mod. Now, having said that, it's your Cosmverse. If you're like, I don't want that one with that one, okay, don't. No problem. It doesn't bother me. But that's the home game answer, right? So what I think as a GM or as a player, if you're going to go, I'm going to spend the 96 XP and put all of these pieces, parts in my gun, talk to your GM, tell them what you plan to do, and work it out on how the GM's going to interpret that and what things are going to happen and whether or not, you know, occult energy reconfigures your gun. You have all these little pieces, parts that you can put together. Is it a free action? Is it combined action? What is, you know, is it doable at all? You know, these, or your GM has gone down and said, these things are not compatible with these things. If you pick this route, you're not going to be able to pick this route, whatever, blah, blah, blah. I will say that the one thing that stands out to me, and it's under pistol stock, is where it says both pistols count as the same weapon for trademark weapon and other abilities. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have two guns. You have a Slayer's gun that has been modified, and now you're holding two weapons, but they count as the same gun. So that may be that one line may is important for other interpretations, specifically trademark weapon. I'm not doing two attacks, I'm doing one attack. I might be shooting at multiple things, but when I do my damage, trademark weapon considers these two things as my trademark weapon, singular. So, and other abilities. So if you're going to do stuff like I'm dual wielding, I get two weapons and I got two bonuses now. No, you don't. You have a weapon. I want to do short burst. I have two guns, the same thing. So I should be able to short burst. No, you don't. Repeating action has to be taken for this gun, this single weapon, to gain the short burst property. So you don't have two guns to get short burst until you take repeating action. And that's important, but that's a home game thing. So in Torgonized play, I think we've ruled that this is all unrestricted access. And so we use the term table variation. And you're going to have some, if we get other GMs to run some stuff, you're going to have some table variation on how the various GMs run things. If you've got a Slayer's gun that has eight different mods on it, you might want to mention that when you sit down at a organized play table to run some Delphi Council mission stuff and say, hey, I got this. How are you going to tell me that this works? I just want to get that out front so I understand, you know, when I go to do this, I don't stop the game for 20 minutes while we look stuff up. How do you want to deal with that? And get it out of the way up front. because, you know, if you're springing it on your GM, that's what's going to happen. The GM's going to go, whoa, wait, what? And now we got to look some stuff up. But if you give it to him up front and say, this is what I've got, what are we doing? You might get like a negative reaction, like, I don't know why you took that. That doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Okay, table variation. You just got to roll with it. But for me, I'm okay. Take it. Run with it. Let's play. Let's have a good time.
And that is a good point to make. A lot of new games, especially with Torg Eternity, were about transparency, not necessarily hiding things. It's not a player versus game master mentality. So I know, and it's sometimes hard to break if you've played old school games and you have had that player versus game master, or the players going, hey, game master, could you leave the room while we come up with the plan, because you're afraid that the game master is going to listen to you and then come up with 100 different ways to make that plan not work. That's not what Torg Eternity is about. So if you come in, like Mark said, with a character that you want to have all these things with, you know, say, hey, this is what I think, what are you going to allow or disallow as the game master, so we don't stop the game for 20 minutes either looking up rules or arguing about, you know, rules and stopping everybody else's fun. So this would be something that I would bring up at the beginning to clear, you know, any and all possible for future miscommunications. So that was our answer for those last two questions. So thank you very much, Oliver, for those. And then the second email that we got is from T again. Hi, guys. We just finished Dr. Y and the Jiangshi and thoroughly enjoyed every moment. One of the PC sacrificed themselves in the final act and led us to the most bittersweet moments in years. For the next adventure, my group has stated a preference for a Core Earth adventure. Do you have any suggested Core Earth resources and adventures? Many thanks, as always. Your podcast continues to be one of the high points of my week. All the best, T. So thank you for continuing to listen to our ramblings on the Torg Eternity Delphi Council debriefings. For the two things... The first one, Core Earth Adventures, not yet. We don't really... We have Core Earth scenes that happen in Core Earth, but there's not a whole lot out there that are adventures in Core Earth. We do realize that that is something lacking. But for resources, we are going to now move into the rest of this episode. And as I talked about at the beginning, talking about the setting slash purpose of the game. So we're going to get into the setting slash purpose of Core Earth. Give some... Mark, you wanted to...
Can I throw one thing at that email?
Sure.
Before you move too far away. Tombstorm is a Delphi Council Delphi Council missions. It takes place in Core Earth, but it's not... necessarily Core Earth.
Right.
I'm a fan of, you know, I'm a fan of the rule of two, where anything you would do in Core Earth, I would not want to just adventure in Core Earth. I would want to have Cosm show up in Core Earth. Tombstorm is kind of a Core Earthy thing that's got some other stuff going on, which I think you, if you look at that one, that might be the way to go. But
that one's fun. I liked going game mastering that one. Going on, we'll hit the resources. So places you might look for in different media, TV shows, books, etc., for Core Earth. So Core Earth is our close to the real world Earth with a little bit of magic, a little bit of mystic psionics, a little bit of miracles going on. And it's been explained a lot. And again, we are talking about the knee-jerk explanation to get somebody to go, oh, that's what it's like. But then we want to expand it so that that's not always what it is. So what's always been explained is Core Earth is a near real world Earth in which movies such as Die Hard are documentaries. So that's kind of the knee-jerk reaction. So let's go further into that, and let's talk about other things that you might look into Core Earth-wise to round it out a little bit more and get a little flesh it out some. And when you go, when you're game mastering adventures, you might make based off of certain media out there or ways to think about things. And as a player, especially if you're a Core Earth player, what things you might also use. So Jay, let's start with you for your Core Earth stuff.
So Core Earth is, I mean, you've already said the main one, Die Hard. And I think Die Hard is actually an important example because I also will think of things like Commando and stuff, but Commando's a little bit more over the top. We're kind of like delving into Nile Empire territory.
Right. And sometimes there's that fine line between Nile Empire and
it's like
Core
Last
Earth.
Action Hero.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're not Last Action Hero. Die Hard is still somewhat gritty, right? There's an underdog. There's a glorious explosion. there's a lot of things that work with it. So that kind of covers the action element to it. There's a little bit of overlap with Pan Pacifica with the hard-boiled detectives and everything as well. But Die Hard in that kind of action really fits. Then you get, for the psionics, remember, it's a little more subtle, but it does exist. And the government has been, the governments have all been, exploring all of this kind of stuff, like Project Rasputin and everything, which leads to the Institute. But movies like Men Who Stare at Goats, so not as overt, right? Like as it is in Tharkold, but that can bring you into some interesting stuff. Because don't forget, Core Earth still has a fairly high social axiom. And along with Pan Pacifica, they're the reality that is most able to leverage their axioms, pretty much. Like Tharkold has the best social. Cyberpapacy has the best tech. But they're both hindered due to just their world laws and how the world works. Whereas Core Earth and Pan Pacifica are able to use them fully. Core Earth, of course, is somewhat constrained by the whole invasion going on. But it's good to have these ideas of what is possible. And then you also get even Hackers, to me, is a movie. Because when you look at it, Core Earth, like if you want to make a hacker character, sure, there's perks specific to it in the cyber papacy for making your custom cyber deck and stuff, but really Core Earth is like the main like hacker cosm. Like there's the internet, you can access anything. In Pan Pacifica, you have to go into the building that you want to hack. In the cyber papacy, anyone who puts their trodes on or whatever can walk around and just do it. You don't actually need special skills. Although if you are a nodder, you basically trivialize any content, which is a whole separate issue. And then in Tharkold, you have to go to hell. So you want to avoid that. So there's a, so things like security cameras and all those like sneakers and Ocean's 11 kind of style heists really fit in Core Earth, and especially with the Law of Aegis and a lot of stuff from other cosms being stashed in Core Earth, including Eternity Shards, there's all kinds of heists available. And then the other big thing is that often gets overlooked is that because a lot of it was kind of like hidden away in the Torg Retreat sort of add-on for Aurors, but Core Earth does have some magical traditions. There's secret societies out there. And I find movies like The Ninth Gate really fits my Core Earth magic vibe. There's cults. They are subtle. They're not flinging fireballs everywhere, but they are influential people. They're doing deals, and it's more about like finding some rare tome somewhere that's been lost for the ages and no one knows how to use it, but a Storm Knight or someone who takes it to a ley line nexus somewhere where the magic axiom is higher can actually use it. So that kind of covers it. It's kind of a weird situation where there's action in Core Earth, but there's also more mystery in Core Earth. It really depends on what you're exploring. And that's why I don't necessarily think you always need to overlay another reality onto Core Earth, but you still want to have other realities around. Like, sure, there's some Nile Shock Troopers here or some Pan Pacifica, you know, infiltrators here, but it's still a Core Earth location. And it's one of those things that kind of gets me. I almost want to force my groups, whenever they make characters, to always have at least one Core Earth character in the group. So at least all of this means something, you know? So we'll get back to this later, but that's part of what doing missions in Core Earth is also about, is seeing the impact that actually happens, like the actual war, the people who are actually being invaded. But those are some of the ones that I could think of offhand.
Mark, let's go over to you. What are some of the things that you would want to let Game Masters and players know about Core Earth?
I had this laid out, and then at the very last minute, I'm like, I can't believe I'm going to say this. It's important to know kind of, I guess, where in the timeline your game starts. Because day one is very different from day 364. There's a lot of changes and things that have happened in between. And one of my players has been pecking at me about the game I've been running, going, where are we in the timeline? I'm like, I don't know. And I kind of just write it for Torg Eternity, but Torg Eternity has a progression down a line. And there are changes and that happen in the world, and specifically the game is about Core Earth, because it's the Possibility Wars are the invasion of, we didn't call it Core Earth, we called it Earth, until, because we didn't know about the Nile Empire and we didn't know about Isle and we didn't know about Tharkold and the rest of this until they invaded, right? And now they've shown up, and so we have to, the parts of our world that haven't changed, what do we call that? Well, that's Core Earth. You know, they've got different names for it. We call it Core Earth. To me, you've got, you can't really, just like the game Torg Eternity isn't about one genre of gaming, I don't think you can really pin down Core Earth as a single genre. You can set up Core Earth as world laws and talk about the world, the whole Law of Hope, the Law of Glory, the Law of the Underdog, and all the rest of it, and say that's Core Earth, and that would be correct. But I think when you change your geographic location, and from the standpoint of the game master and setting, the temporal location on where in the timeline you want to start your game or run your game, that's going to change it too. I mean, for example, if you set it in the U.S., cryptids are much more of a thing, because you've got, you know, Bigfoot and that kind of thing. Unless you go over to England, then you got Loch Ness Chupacabra on the southern border. You got some other stuff. And cryptids, we don't call them cryptids. The world doesn't. Other places in the world don't call them cryptids. But from a game standpoint, we would categorize them as cryptids. Because if you go to, say, Japan, they've got foo creatures. Those would be, I would think those would categorize as cryptids to a certain degree. But, you know, if you go to Core Earth in Japan, which if you found a spot there that's still Core Earth, foo monsters could be a thing. You go to Ireland, if there was a spot still Core Earth, you got fae. I mean, that's an Irish thing, but these aspects that we would consider, those things we consider legend and myth, and mystery have floated more to the surface and poked through in some places and are actual real things. From the standpoint of what does Core Earth generally, universally kind of feel like, I would go with the idea of something like a Stargate SG-1 or, maybe the Tomorrow War, kind of thing, or Edge of Tomorrow, where you've got this invasion that's come in, but it's not so much in Edge of Tomorrow and Tomorrow War. You've got this overt, we're mobilizing every human being ever known, period, and everybody knows what's going on, and it's one place, and we got to go there and get it. But, you know, with Torg Eternity, you've got swaths of the planet that have just been decimated. They're devastated. They're gone. Like when the Living Land dropped in, all of the Eastern Seaboard, that's Living Land now. It's not. It's like it's gone, because those cities don't exist as cities. They've been taken over by the Living Land. The Cosm has instituted its world laws. Everything has begun to decay. Whatever, the jungle's taken over, etc. And so wherever that is, it's, you know, thousands of years through a post-Holocaust and what comes after kind of setting. But outside of that, you know, Texas is still Texas, right? Montana is still Montana. If you get far enough away from either coast in the United States, you get to the heartland where it still looks just like it did. And it still operates just like it did. They just got news about all this other stuff going on. So are there people there who might even think that, you know, this isn't real and it's not happening? Well, maybe. I mean, but now let's change it up and go to a different portion of the globe. And you get some places that are core Earth in different areas of the world. You've changed the setting to a degree, but only because you've changed the geography. So if you wanted to say it's Die Hard in, you know, some area in Southeast Asia that's unaffected, you could, but it's not. Die Hard is, you know, just that's Christmas in the U.S. It's a Christmas movie, and if you don't think so, you're wrong. But, you know, you pick up Die Hard and drop Die Hard over at some other place where they don't speak English and their traditions are different, it's not Die Hard anymore. What is it? You get to figure that out. So, I like to go down the road more of a Stargate SG-1 kind of thing, where you've got the Delphi Council is this funded and connected to the government, but otherwise lesser known entity, if not even covert, because they've got to go do stuff, but they're a small group. They have a lot of power because the governments recognize the governments know what's going on. Because they can't exert their influence and control over there. The Adinos just won't listen. They don't, you know, it's beyond their social axiom for one thing. But, you know, so the government knows something's happening. And here comes Quinn Sebastian. And I don't want to steal some thunder from some stuff that's been written. But here comes Quinn Sebastian. And Quinn Sebastian knows stuff. And now everybody in the world, regardless of government, kind of listens to him because he demonstrated that he knows things. Right? And so he's effective, regardless of what you think of him as a person or a character in the game. He's effective, and that commands a certain amount of respect. So core Earth, and he's core Earth as far as we know. Right. So this small covert group. Go ahead, Jay.
No, I was just saying.
This small cadre of people led by someone who knows what's going on are the only effective agents against this. And the longer that goes, is your story a dark story or a hopeful story? If it's a dark story, the war is turning against them and their numbers are dwindling. If it's a hopeful story, they're gaining ground and their numbers are growing. The good news is the players are Storm Knights and part of that group, or group adjacent, however you want to do it, and you get to figure out how you're playing or what kind of story you want to tell. But to me, that's core Earth. It's that small group of freedom fighters fighting against the invaders, you know, Red Dawn kind of thing.
I just thought Red Dawn right before you said it. So adding to that, a few things that I would think of, while the knee-jerk reaction would be to put John Wick into Pan Pacifica, I think a lot of that could fit into Core Earth, because there's no, it's not like wire foo type stuff going on. It's more grounded in, you know, what they...
John Wick 1.
Also, when we get into the mystic stuff, there's an old series, Friday the 13th, series. Not anything to do with the movies with Jason, but...
Warehouse 13.
Or Warehouse 13. Those, I would say, would be an appropriate Core Earth type thing for the magic and stuff going on, where there is like cursed items that do stuff, but it's not like everybody knows, like barely anybody knows that they're there, and it's investigative type stuff. Mark had pointed out the cryptid type things, so you have that in on it. It's just a little bit more, some, not all by any means, but some of the really more mundane X-File stuff I could see, you know, being a Core Earth type setting. Yes, while Stargate 1, not by going to other planets and dimensions and such, but having a paramilitary organization that is sending people to other places that aren't the same doing stuff, I think that's actually a good analogy to kind of put it as a, you know, there were people on Earth that then crossed over through a Stargate. They went through a Stele border, you know, a reality storm. Boom, they're in a place that does things differently. And then, you know, they come back for resupply and, you know, give the intelligence and debriefings and stuff. So that's a good way to think about that if that's what you're trying to think. But otherwise, I think we hit a nice list of things other than the traditional just Die Hard, which fits, but we wanted to give a little more stuff out there. So take a look at Stargate. Take a look at their SG-1.
It'll only take you a few years to go through Stargate.
Oh, no, stop at season 8. Season 8's where you should end that.
And you know, go back, see if you can find Friday the 13th or Warehouse 13. I think that's a nice way of just, there's some magic power type stuff in there, but for the most part, the main characters aren't. They're just normal people trying to do the good job to keep these cursed items, you know, away from doing bad things. I think is a good theme that fits the Core Earth theme also on a lesser grand scale, but it fits. So having said that, hopefully you've got some good information. When we come back in a few weeks, we'll get into the other realities. We do encourage you. Yes.
I did want to add before we stop, there's not really very much in the way of official adventures and source books and things like that for Core Earth. And personally, I don't really consider Tombstorm a Core Earth adventure. But there are some on the Infiniverse Exchange. I have not played all of these or read them even, but Siskoid just released one like a week ago called Political Scales, which is about the repercussion, some lesser thought of repercussions of the Nashville incident. There is also one of the like first adventures, I think, that was on the Infiniverse Exchange was the Yanis Agenda Day One, which is a Core Earth adventure, which eventually leads to other places and other adventures. And I had one as well, Operation Grim Harvest on there, which I have since decided is probably a bit overtuned. So if you ever do get that one, you know, don't throw all of the bad guys at them at once. That's all I'm saying.
My first thing that I published was Rooting Out Aurorsch, which is a nightmare tree set in a suburban Core Earth area.
There we go. About so that. There's always the Infiniverse Exchange.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There always is. Dig into the Infiniverse Exchange. If nothing else, you can get some good ideas. Even, and that's a lot with anything. If you get into something and you're like, eh, I can't quite, I don't think I can use that as an adventure. There's probably some stuff in it that are...
almost any cyberpunk adventure can be turned into a Core Earth adventure.
And Hackers was the good one. I think we even used the Hack the World in one of our streams. Hack the Planet. We do encourage you to write us at torgdcd@gmail.com. You can send us your questions like Oliver and T did, and we will answer them, sometimes long-winded. Sometimes we'll then go into an actual episode and try to answer through an entire episode. Or if you just want to comment, we're always happy to hear from you all. Otherwise, until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.